Welcome to the Adventures in Awareness podcast. This is Amir Giles. And in this first series, Psychedelics, Meditation and Enlightenment, we're partnering with the Psychedelic Society, examining how psychedelics might interact with meditation and other practices, specifically when in the pursuit of fundamental and persistent changes to how we experience reality. I'm really happy in this first conversation to have Daniel Ingram joining us, since as a doctor, he brings a clinical mindset drawing on 12 years experience teaching medicine, combined with 26 years experience of hardcore meditation practices across several traditions, which have resulted in his mind being studied at some of the top research centers in the world. As you'll hear, he's familiar with arguments on both sides of the debate around if psychedelics might either help or harm progress towards what he considers formal awakening. And if you're curious about including entheogens as part of your path, it's really worth hearing the many thoughtful considerations and resources that he brings. If you find this conversation useful, please consider subscribing to catch future installments and supporting us on Patreon/Adventures in Awareness. So, with no further ado, we bring you Dr. Daniel Ingram.
Yeah, so I'm obviously extremely aware of the psychedelic renaissance. I actually am working to organize research teams that involve two people who are members of the Imperial College London Psychedelic Research Lab as part of that, and have been reaching out to MAPS since the beginning of starting this project that I'm working on, and working with a person from the Zendo Project who does a trip sitting basically at and skillful psychedelic support at festivals and helps with that project. And so also a reasonable number of the people who I'm working with one way or another got into this or had some important psychedelic experience that then was part of their journey that showed them other ways of perceiving the world that expanded them out from their previously more narrow ways of looking at things. And so, yeah, that's baked into a lot of what I'm working on right now. So these topics come up a lot. And as an ER physician, I have seen that side of it. And as a meditation teacher and practitioner who's done psychedelics, not any great number of times, but enough to get a sense of what they're about, then, you know, I have that experience. And I was also on the road with rock bands for 6 years, a long time ago. And so I got to see that side of it. And hanging out at, 2,000 person festivals out in the woods with people wandering around, naked and music playing and people cooking together, and that sort of culture, which was something I was spending some time in my 20s. And yeah, so I've got that background to it. And coming into this, I've got a lot of frameworks that come from the Theravada, but I've studied a lot of mystical traditions. I'm basically an obsessive student of maps of meditation, of noticing their similarities, their differences, the kind of patterns that seem to repeat again and again, the sort of particulars that seem to be unique to various paths, and thinking a lot about that as well as how to study that. How do you actually make some kind of clinical, reasonable sense of this? Because the traditions each end up being kind of like martial arts was before mixed martial arts, where karate thinks it's the best and judo thinks it's the best and whatever. They all think taekwondo is the best, and they all think, and they all have their little world and their little way of doing things. And then mixed martial arts sort of put them together and showed that none of the traditions were the best. It was a mixture of them, by the way, with some common sense and throwing out some harmful dogma that was actually something that worked better in that violent context. And the same analogy actually works for hopefully nonviolent contexts of spiritual progress and practice. So I'm as critical of the traditions as I am appreciative of their bits of wisdom. And I'm very much a pragmatist at heart. So that's something of my background. And then beginning with the question of how do psychedelic experiences relate to the path of awakening is super complicated. The first thing is there's very little formal research on this. So even those of us who think we know a reasonable amount about this are talking based on our own experiences, case studies, the experiences of our friends and partners and fellow journeyers on the path, which is going to be somewhat limited. You know, whatever reading we've done on like Arrowhead or sites like that, I actually give to Arrowhead every year as part of their, you know, annual fundraising campaign, because I think it's important to spend a reasonable amount of time reading through that site. and you get to see the good, the bad, the ugly, and they're just very strange. It's hard to make sense of. And then I also, I hung out a shingle a long time ago, which said, basically, I'm very interested in helping people with their spiritual journey and helping to normalize and stabilize and help people. And I'll do that for free. And when you hang out a shingle like that on the internet, you get a whole lot of people who will contact you and take advantage of that service. I won't even take donation for this, right? So it's just a clean service I provide to people. And then these days, probably a third of the people I talk with, which are, you know, I don't know how many hundred a year, it's a reasonable number. I'll talk to three people about these topics today, for example. I talk with a lot of people, and maybe a third of them have gotten into this through psychedelics or recently had some part of the process substantially impacted by psychedelics, sometimes very positively, sometimes very negatively, and sometimes just something really weird, and they don't know what to make of it, but it seems somehow significant. And so that's my kind of basis of experience coming into this conversation.
Brilliant.
And so just so people have some idea of who I am and where I'm coming from. But all of us who are doing this, we don't have great science on this yet. We have the studies out of the 50s and 60s that kind of largely got shelved, and I haven't read that many of them, but they did a lot of very interesting work exploring psychedelics and their potential for mostly psychotherapy. So they were not really thinking about awakening back then in any formal sense, and people would have these weird experiences. They didn't really have great frameworks for them. And then you come to the Grofs, who, and some people who were influenced by the Grofs and kind of in that cohort, who really began to think about this more from a transhumanist perspective, more of in a spiritual kind of way, even than the researchers before. They were doing some of that, but not quite as formal. And they started trying to categorize the stuff and make some sense of it and sort of put together some loose frameworks, which led to things like the Mystical Experiences Questionnaire and stuff like that, which I really don't like that much, in all honesty, but I really appreciate that it's there so we have something to react to and hopefully improve upon. At least it's a start. And then you get into like my background with formal practices leading to awakening, very formal theory coming out of the Theravada, which are the maps that I go back to again and again and again. I augment them with some Hindu stuff and some Christian stuff, but really my core is very core Theravada Buddhist tech, because for better or for worse, I just don't see anything that really improves on it. Like their maps were so good and they did such a good job kind of straight out of the gate about 2000 years ago that I just look at them and I go, wow, like y'all were just awesome at this. It's like, you know, there were people in medieval times, like in the Middle East, who were just great anatomists. They just were awesome at dissecting corpses and describing things. And there were, you know, and like, there's a lot of their anatomy we still use, like, cause they just got it right. Like they were just really good at, and in the same kind of way, the Theravada maps, the old school Buddhist maps of the tradition of the elders or whatever, which is mostly out of like Burma and Sri Lanka and Thailand, were just really good at this. And so then you come to, how do you apply those maps, which largely weren't in a psychedelic context, unless you believe books like The Secret Drugs of Buddhism, saying they were really actually tripping back then as well, in addition to meditating, that's a whole nother story. But like, how do these apply then to modern psychedelic experiences? And with psychedelics, they didn't even have then, right? They didn't have access to, I don't know if they had DMT, they certainly didn't have 5-MeO, I don't think. You know, they didn't have ketamine, they didn't have MDMA. And right, so, and then the question is, how well do those maps apply to this? So I'm giving a long background answer to the question, but I want people to understanding kind of where I'm coming from so that you can realize this is just one person's limited perspective. Even if I sound super certain about stuff, I realize I'm just one guy. We don't have great science on this. Okay, so that's enough disclaimers and background. And then we get to like, what do I think the psychedelics do? And then I've got to talk about a little map theory. So is it clearly true that some people just take psychedelics and they get high and they come down and it really doesn't seem to change them? Yeah, right? So I know a lot of people who partied a lot, but do they think of any of their experiences as mystical or life-changing or super profound? Well, actually, no. And actually, when I talk to people who have had very profound, life-changing, sort of mystical-y experiences on psychedelics, some of them who have then tried to induce this in their friends have been frustrated because they think everybody is going to have some life-changing thing that, like, you know, blows their mind and makes them an utterly different person and skitter off in some totally different direction. Like, and they're kind of frustrated when not that doesn't happen to all of their friends. So we have almost kind of two camps. We have the people who get high and come down, and they go, well, that was interesting. Yeah, but it was just a fun party thing or whatever, or it was really weird, or maybe it helped them with sort of see some issue. But it didn't have that like mind-blowing mystical feel to it, even if they describe, you know, the classic psychedelic phenomenology. It didn't hit at that level for them. And then you have this other camp, they're like, no. This is the gateway. This is the path. This is what opened my mind to the mysteries of the universe. And I've never been the same since, and I can't look at reality the same way again. And for a lot of them, that was really good. For some of them, that was really like shattering and damaging. But one way or another, they sort of form their own camp. And then you've got the people who really have a positive valence on this, right? So the people who think, okay, this was unbelievably like world-like benefiting. I'm like utterly changed and transformed. This healed me. This helped me. And then I talked to some people who this stuff just broke them. Like, this stuff just screwed them up. Like, they may have had something interesting and profound. And, you know, weeks, months, years later, they're still trying to put back together something of what got kind of shattered in that process. That doesn't mean it may not ultimately be beneficial, right? So a lot of people who I've talked to who, you know, 20 years ago went through, or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, back in the day, you know, or 50 years ago, back in the psychedelic first wave, right, had this stuff really screw them up. And then years or decades later, they put something back together and eventually got something out of it. But it was a long, hard process, right? And so you've got kind of all these different categories of people who have these experiences. And then you have a much smaller percentage of people who, when they had these, they got something that was really permanent and better, right? Something that was truly a lasting transformation, not just as a memory or something they can kind of access and think about, but something that is now hardwired into who they are and how reality is sort of automatically processed at that very, very deep level that I think of as the level of like permanent transformations of formal awakening.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's also true that a lot of people in meditation don't get that either, right? They get something that may have changed them and they're now different, but it's not what I would really think of as formal levels of awakening. And the number of people in both of those camps, meditators and people taking psychedelics, that have had that is actually relatively small, right? They may have had something profound, but did it rise to the level I would think of as good old school formal awakening, where they now have formal capabilities and their perception is fundamentally transformed and they are automatically perceiving something in the natural luminous centerlessness of unfolding immediate timeless experience or something at their baseline in an unshakable way? Well, that's actually a relatively small percentage of both meditators and people taking psychedelics. But is it clearly true that most people who take psychedelics are going to have a much more profound experience than people who just sit down on the cushion and start trying to count their breath or whatever? Well, yeah, that's their kind of whole claim to fame. And that's why they're an amazing tool in the toolbox, as it were, because most people, as Terence McKenna very rightly points out, within 30 minutes to an hour to a few seconds, depending on what modality and route of administration you're taking this stuff, is going to have something really wild happening, right? There are very few people who seem to be kind of psychedelic immune, where you give them a dose and they go, yeah, meh, whatever, right? That almost never happens, as opposed to meditation, where that happens pretty routinely. So all that said, my core take on this, and then I'll give you some space to talk. I realize I've been talking a lot,
but that'll give you a lot
to react to. You know, my take on this, having had some experiences myself and talked to a lot of people, is that I do know a few people who I think got into really formal awakening stages based on psychedelics. It's a small percentage. I know a lot of people who got tossed way deep into powerful spiritual territory that gave them a profound taste of something, kind of like, you know, the rocket ship blasted off and then they, you know, they came back down to earth, but they were forever changed by what they've seen. But like, are they now like, yeah. So, and particularly with like DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, but certainly, you know, other substances as well, obviously psilocybin and LSD and its variants and are profound molecules. But I also know a number of people who have had super profound experiences on salvia, on ketamine. And, you know, you end up having people who are sort of devotees of certain molecules, right? That's the one that really gets me to that place. All of that said, I know very, very few people who actually through psychedelics got to what I think of as formal awakening. And really got the sort of level of meditation mastery and depth and reproducibility and sort of deep chronic changes of their perception that happen from longer term formal meditation. I've also been in a lot of meditation retreats with people who are serious psychedelic aficionados. They've done hundreds of doses of very powerful, cool, high-end, low-end, whatever, wide range of things for a long time, and also very much appreciate the depth that comes from like doing a 3-week fire or 1-month fire casino retreat where we just are practicing all day long without any substances on board, except maybe a little caffeine for some people. And the what that leads to, which is, I think, from an organic point of view, writing deeper structural changes in the brain because it just has more time, right? So I think for the dendrites to grow and for the deeper brain connections to be integrated, most psychedelics are just way too short. Even ibogaine, which is super powerful and lasts a long time, 36 hours is not a lot of time for dendrites to grow. And while you may have a lot of increased connectability and changes in the way neurons may wire together and stuff that maybe has been demonstrated after some of these experiences, it's still not as long as what the formal, deep, super big structural changes that come from formal meditation are. But that said, I do know a few people who seem to have woken up on psychedelics, but it's a very, very small percentage in comparison to the number that think they did, because they crossed something super impressive I would call the arising and passing away, which can make a lot of people think they're enlightened. But it's really just a first entrance into a deeper process. Okay, sorry, that was a super long diatribe, but hopefully that got a lot of summarized information that we can now react to. Okay, what do you got?
No, well, I'm pleased my instinct was right, which was to record this and recognize that there'd be lots of wonderful information shared. I think just knowing that there is a wide variation in what people mean when they say awakening, and some people listening to this, I'm sure, will not have been exposed to hardly any of them. They'll just have this vague notion and maybe even suspicious, does it even exist? So we'll leave that debate aside maybe for now. But just in terms of, and I'll refer people as well in some links to books you've written on this, but if you can sum up as briefly as you can of what you refer to when you mean formal awakening, and then we can dig into that a little bit in terms of how psychedelics might help move people in that direction or how they might get in the way. But yeah, just a couple of comments on what you mean by formal awakening as opposed to a temporary awakening experience. Or
yeah, so getting into, okay, a little more map depth. So the maps I'm coming from, I'm a huge fan of. And as a clinician, as a scientist, I just see these patterns again and again and again in people. They hold up weirdly robustly across different traditions, across different techniques, across psychedelics and, you know, states-induced and non-psychedelic contexts or mixed contexts where you're doing meditation and psychedelics together or whatever. And I just think there's something physiological. And I have now been doing this so long, like, unfortunately, like, as a scientist, I can't unsee this. I can't, like, there's going to be no changing my views on this for better or for worse, because I've literally talked to thousands of people where these were just really good explanatory frameworks and models that offered a lot in terms of sequence. So the first sequence is like the arising and passing away. This is what a lot of people would call Kundalini awakening. This is the peak state that a lot of the Maslow studied, that William James would call it, you know, his varieties of religious experience would call it the twice born. These are people who have had like religious conversion experiences. They've seen the light. You know, when they came up on psychedelics, they're like, oh my God, this blew my consciousness. I was seeing this bright, massive love light of God that was flooding through me with vibrations of the cosmic fractal, you know, whatever. Like, this is this thing, right? And a lot of people seem to get something like this on 5-MeO. It seems to be like a weirdly powerful chemical for inducing this. Certainly mushrooms and DMT and, you know, or also an LSD are really common places to have this happen. Mescaline is another one that I know a bunch of people who had this happen. And this is like the thing that changes you, and you're never the same. You can't go back. You've changed your life. You've been tuned on to something. It can be very blissful for a lot of people. Sense of divine love, magical powers, vibrations, vortices, energy, spontaneous movements. All that stuff is this territory. It's a huge topic I could literally do an entire podcast about. You can read about it in my book for free at mctb.org in the section on the arising and passing away in chapter 30. It's all free. Yay. And then you can look up its references. You can look up in like A Path with Heart in chapters 9 and 10. They'll talk a little bit about this. You could look up Abraham Maslow's work. He talked about peak experiences. But this is all that from my point of view. I put all that in this kind of A and P basket, arising and passing away basket. And then that's pretty much going to be followed by the Dark Night in some kind of form or fashion. We could call it the knowledges of suffering, dukkha jnanas, pick your favorite language for this, going into the abyss, the shamanic underworld journey, or hero's journey into the underworld, whatever. I don't care what you call it. it, but this something of that usually follows the peak. So you get this first initiation kind of experience, and then you crash down into something. And it may not be that bad for some people. It's short. For some people, it's very mild. They don't really notice it. For other people, it's like a huge life-wrecking thing. And then you see everything in between, all these variants. It's a big complex topic as well, but sort of it's just big baskets, right? And this is also a very common place for psychedelics to throw people deep, some just like way down into territory, kind of like as a scuba diver. You know, you can go super deep on scuba tanks in a way you can't go just holding your breath for most people, unless you're a really unusually trained athlete. And it's not the same as becoming a fish, but this can give you a taste of what the really deep waters are like. Or if you go up in a spaceship and then you come back down, you weren't actually, a bird or something that could fly naturally into space, but you could blast up and then come back down. This is that. So, and where you might go could be super scary, super profound, all of that. And then there are these open, expansive, unitive spaces that people can get into. I'll just sort of loosely lump into the category of equanimity. Wide, open, expansive, still, super peaceful things with everything just kind of flowing and connected, going through very evenly, like very transparent mind, body, heart structure, emotions just flowing through as these wispy things, super still places. Like that's, you know, and some of the formless stuff that can come out of that, which is more common on like 5-MeO or people doing Toad, you know, with the bufotenin or whatever it is in there. And then, you know, that the sorts of vast spaces of nothingness or time disappearing or space and body and everything disappearing. So that's kind of formless, realmy kind of stuff that can come out of that sort of broad category I'll just kind of call equanimity. All of this is pre-awakening to me because you can see the same pattern of people on intensive meditation retreats very reproducibly again and again and again. The thing about the psychedelics is it tends to be more like it's more like random. It's more chaotic. It's less predictable. Whereas you get to see people develop into the stuff naturally on meditation or other sort of processes like fasting or shamanic journeying or whatever, it tends to unfold more predictively in a stable pattern. Whereas psychedelics are much more like, wow, who knows what you're going to get, right? As everybody who's done enough of this, you just don't know how that trip's going to go and what territory you might suddenly be catapulted into. So it can look a lot wilder, but the patterns still hold up weirdly well. So I think it's just accessing similar states. We actually are going to compare the stuff. We actually have a study. We're going to look at a bunch of people who are doing IVDMT at the Imperial College London study. And we have the same analysis team actually at Oxford who did some of the harmonic connectome analysis that's going to look at our data. And then we're going to actually compare those two data sets of advanced meditators getting into some of these states on command and in control and fMRI and EEG and MEG. And we're going to actually get to compare some of this data. So we're actually going to this stuff we're hypothesizing is the same pathways and the same stuff. Hopefully we'll actually get some neurophenomenological hard science evidence that it's some of the same stuff. Anyways, that's some of the stuff I'm working on that's pretty exciting. But anyway, in the meantime, we're just all kind of spitballing on this stuff, to be fair. But then formal awakening, right? So there's all that stuff which might have body disappearing.
Which you don't call formal awakening.
Yeah, none
it's
of that.
Very impressive and very interesting.
It's
but
super interesting not, yeah. And profound experiences. But the tradition I'm coming from, which is formal Theravada, old school stuff, we would say, yeah, all cool, all fun, all important, all can show you pieces of the puzzle, all can integrate various aspects, the highs, the lows, the transcendent, luminous, natural, expansive, godlike states or whatever. But all temporary. But there's a way to put those all together in a state we would call stream entry or conformity knowledge that then leads to stream entry. And people who have gotten stream entry in this system or first Bumi in the Tibetan systems or pick your favorite, Zen is vague on this stuff, whether or not you want to call it Kensho or Satori. They can't even define these terms clearly and they don't really know what they mean, but they use them a lot. And it's interesting. They don't have the formal technical precision of the Theravada or even the Tibetans, which are way more flowery and colorful and kind of poetic. But people who have formal stream entry are formally different. They can just literally just sit down and drop down to meditation stages that people who aren't stream enterers can't. They cycle much more rapidly through the highs and lows, maybe in terms of hours or days or even minutes, rather than over sort of weeks, months, years for most people who are doing this pre-stream entry. That's what entering the stream is. It's really more entering like the swirl, entering the cycle of these things. They suddenly have access to a layer of mind just at a whim that other people don't, and they can navigate, learn to navigate through these stages, you know, in a whole sit, or even just in stages of daily life, have them roll through. They can resynchronize their brain, have it vanish, disappear, reappear in daily life if they learn to do some of the stuff or have some talent for it, and it may show up spontaneously. And they're now in a process that, while it was sort of formally started by the arising and passing away, this is now way more in it. So like they're going to cycle much more rapidly, move through these things. Deeper layers of mind are going to show themselves to them. Basically, they can't even avoid it. Even if they stop practice, they don't do any more psychedelics. This is a process that is now activated for them, and they're going to be in it, journeying through these things in a way that people above the arising and passing away have also, but it's much more rapid, quick, integrated, powerful, deep, and can access, just from my point of view, just deeper brain structures. And I know people who have done like 5-MeO and Ibogaine are like, what deeper brain structures are you talking about? How is that possible? Like, what do you even mean, dude? Like, do you even know what you're talking about? Actually, I do know what I'm talking about. And there are just deeper levels of integration and possibility even out beyond those. It may not have all the fireworks of those, but it's something you can walk in around and have at your integrated baseline, which is a sort of categorically different in some way. Not that those experiences can't change your paradigm and can't change something about you, see way you see the world. 5-MeO in particular seems to stand out, right? I don't mean to keep singing the praises of Toad, but to have to give it its due, right? It does something to people a lot of the time if you get a big enough dose of it and it hits you right or whatever. But that said, I don't think that's this for most people, but we need better science on this. We don't have great phenomenology. We're not generally taking people who have had super profound experiences in some of these psychedelics and formally testing them against advanced meditators, but that's actually some of the studies I want to do. So by the way, if you're listening to this and you're a philanthropist and you think this is kind of important work to study and you're interested in brain and the study of consciousness and mind and human attentional possibilities and awakening and all that stuff and the spiritual journey, please talk to me, because I would love to hook you up with the researchers who are actually doing this, and they need funding because these studies are very, very expensive, hundreds of thousands to millions to tens of millions of dollars. The fMRI time is expensive. These people's academic time is expensive. Please get in touch with me. Hopefully you will include a link below and wherever you post this. But I would love to talk with you, because we need to do more science on this so that all of us aren't just kind of talking out of our heads and taking our best guesses. Okay, so that was a whole lot more information. And then for way more formal stages of awakening, you can actually get to places where, like, you no longer have any sense of a doer, knower, beer, controller that's at any part of this. Everything is just naturally unfolding in a timeless, luminous, integrated moment, just as a full thing, as a baseline thing that isn't a temporary altered state, but all states can move through and they don't change that aspect of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's really like high formal stages of awakening. We could talk about various language for that, various ways people explain that. But that's, I haven't seen anybody who got that from psychedelics. I've seen people who got tastes of it for brief periods, but never formally integrated. It's like, that's just who they are now. There's no shaking it. It's all the time at all moments equally. And that's one of the things that a lot of my friends who are both super deep meditators and have done psychedelics have said, yes, okay, super cool, very profound, very important, an important part of my path. I'm so grateful I had all that, but I want it integrated as my walking around all the time thing, right? I'm tired of it having just being a memory or something I can get to for brief periods or moments if I'm lucky and the psychedelic hits me right. And then that's available for people who want to do that kind of work. But for most people, that generally seems to involve, with rare exceptions, like you have these weird people like Peace Pilgrim who just chanced into it just kind of spontaneously or whatever, or Punjaji, right? Or, you know, these people who just woke up, right? It happens, but it's very rare. But if you want a much higher chance of that happening to you, most people are going to require, it seems, much more long-term formal deep training that integrates those glimpses into something lasting and more profound. And that's the kind of stuff I think of as like formal higher stages of awakening. So anyway, I've been talking a whole lot. More questions?
Yeah, it's great, but it's all just like such useful information and really valuable to get this conversation going. And these glimpses that people can have in psychedelics of these states or insights or whatever, do you think that makes the formal practice of meditation more likely to be beneficial? And I know you have no data necessarily, but there's just a lot of conversations you've had with many different people, or perhaps just your intuition. Is there a sense of, like, ideally, if they weren't illegal, you know, would everyone going on a meditation retreat, if all the necessary precautions were taken, would you start them off with a high dose of 5-MeO? Or is it too much of, you know, it could push people the wrong way or get them excited for the wrong reasons? Or
So these are hugely debated in my circles, which tend to involve a lot of high-end psychonauts and meditators and people who are both, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, rather than being sure I have the right answer to that question, which I don't think I do, so just to be fair, I can tell you what the debates are. And then we need to sort this out. So this is definitely a call for formal research on this stuff. There are clearly people who were weirdly resistant to meditation, and then you give them a dose of psychedelics, it blows their consciousness into territory for whatever reason they were having a super hard time getting into that they think is super profound, and they're like, okay, now I know what I'm looking for. And it opens and starts something, almost like cracking some wall, right? And you know, I'm sure you know plenty of people who have described something like this. If you've done psychedelics yourself, you may know what I'm talking about. Like, okay, I had no idea. Wow, okay. They don't think they could have gotten there on their own, or maybe a lot of meditation later, they hadn't gotten there on their own. And then this really worked for them as an opener, like as an introduction, like as a direction of a possibility. It was super important. And to be honest, a lot of the hippies that later became deep spiritual practitioners in Asia who taught me, who sometimes went on to become monks and things, and then became like one of my meditation teachers, got into the stuff the first time on psychedelics. And they were like, okay, there's a there. And that's super important, because without that, they may be wandering a long time and just have nothing, which is really frustrating, because I know a lot of people have done a lot of meditation and they don't have a lot out of it, right? So there's that, right? To give psychedelics their due. True. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. And then there's the problem of when you take these things, it's could be super unintegrated, hard to integrate, can catapult sometimes people into territory they were not ready for, that is just kind of world-shattering in the bad way as opposed to the good way, super dark, traumatic, fucked up experiences, excuse my language, that like, holy shit, that was terrible, right? That was just objectively terrible, right? Like, I'm sorry, like that was not a good time. Like, and that just hurt them. And the problem is you don't know what you're going to get. Well, the same is also true for meditation, right? I know people who got into meditation sometimes on strangely small doses, they crossed the arising and passing away. It was cool. And then they crashed into dark territory that was also wrecked their lives. So I'm not sort of saying one or the other. I'm just saying both of them can do this. And we don't know how to look at a person yet and optimize for the one or the other. We don't have good science on how to make sure they have more good trips than bad trips. Not that some people won't say bad trips eventually ended up being something that showed me my darkness and I healed from it. But let's be honest, like some bad trips just friggin' suck and people were not ready for that. And it was just traumatic and it fucked them up, period. Same can happen in meditation. And we don't have good science on this at all. We don't know who are good candidates. We don't have genetic markers. We don't have epigenetics. We don't have good screening questionnaires. We have nothing. We can't tell you at this point which is better for you. And so people are just kind of taking their best guess and whatever feels right to them based on their conditioning, their aesthetics, and whatever social circle they find themselves in and what's available, right, in the country and their risk tolerance profile, as well as they're sort of like, am I a partier adventurer type, or do I want to go the slow, steady, calm, safe path and just like, you know, do 10 minutes of meditation practice today or whatever, right? So all these factors are interacting to create a mix that is super complicated. Okay, I also know people who did a lot of meditation and crossed into some deep territory, but never really had that breakthrough they were looking for. They may have crossed the AMP, got Dark Knight or whatever. And I know some people who, when they took Toad, they were just like, oh my God. Or when they took Ibogaine, they were like, oh, wow, or whatever it was. And they were like, dear, okay, that was what I was looking for in all this meditation. Even those deep meditative experiences I had didn't get me that. Wow, that was so good for me. And then I also know, on the other hand, a whole bunch of people who had a lot of super profound experiences on those and then came back and ended up doing sober fire casino retreats with me because they're like, yeah, I've done that hundreds of times, but it isn't getting me the integration, as I said earlier. And we still don't have good science on this, right? And is it possible that maybe low dose, you know, microdosing, that's been a huge question that gets raised a lot. Maybe microdosing for enhancing meditation, maybe not giving people blowout doses, but what's 10 or 20 mics of acid or like 0.2 or 0.3 grams of mushrooms or whatever doing for you, like maybe that's enhancing. We don't also have good data on that. But I also have some friends who have cautioned me and said, now, wait a second. There's this habituation that can come, right? And then the question is, are these kind of over dumbing down your own centers in your brain where it might have given you an initial taste, but then maybe you're getting more resistant to your own brain chemicals that are supposed to moderate these things, right? So I have some people who have raised that as a concern, that for some of the more magical effects, some of the deeper jhanic effects, maybe you might become dependent, because as anybody who's taken mushrooms or acid knows, if you try to take it the next day again, you're not going to get nearly as much or maybe nothing, right? So there's this, we know for certain from having done the experiment, that there's this receptor downgrade response somehow that happens. And so then the question is, just like, is it the kind of thing with like with opiates or benzos, where you're just desensitizing to yourself, to your own GABA, you know, receptor, you know, or whatever your endorphins are, and then you're going to have this, you're going to feel pain more strongly, or you're going to be more anxious because your own chemicals aren't working as well. And that hasn't been done either. We don't know, but I've had people who have raised those concerns with me based on their own experiences of like, hey, did this shut me out from the magic? And now I have to take mushrooms or acid or whatever to get to the magical experiences. And it's harder for me to do this on my own power, because I can tell you from super deep meditation retreats, there are very profound, mind-blowing magical experiences in other realms and stuff that people can get into. It's just got a much higher cost, right? It's not 30 seconds or a minute and, you know, 15 to 50 bucks or whatever, or 150 bucks if you're doing some high-end thing in a shamanic context, or a few thousand or whatever if you're doing a truffle retreat. But like, it, you know, like the cost to do it the sober way, like the pedestrian path, as I call it, as opposed to the Paisley path, is obviously really high. Like, you know, when we rent, you know, some cool castle or whatever in Scotland, or you know, or some mansion in England or whatever, and spend 3 weeks doing 12, 15 hours a day of practice to hopefully in 70 to 150 hours get to the super profound experiences. Obviously, the opportunity cost for that was nuts in terms of vacation time, back pain, you know, like just the cost of rental in the place. And so you've got to consider all that, like how much time do you have? And then what do you get for the super quick thing that was, you know, one and, you know, you go up, you come down within, you know, hopefully, you know, a few hours to 36, 40, 50 hours later, you're kind of normal again, right? Depending on what you took, versus, you know, us, it takes hundreds of hours over weeks to get up into that super powerful territory a lot of the time. And so you've got to consider opportunity cost, right? And we, again, don't know which is better. I can't tell you. I can tell you there's a range out there. I can tell you that we don't know how any of these things are going to hit you. I can tell you when we do fire casino retreats, even the pedestrian path, the first conversation I start off with is this stuff is not safe. Right. I know people who have freaked out, screamed for hours, had super bad experiences, demons crawling through their spine and other crazy ass stuff. And they got to it straight up sober on meditation. And that was sometimes traumatic. Right. Mm. So like just like mountain climbing or scuba diving, anybody who tells you it's safe, no, it's not safe. Right. You're rewriting the code while the operating system is running. And so like you need to understand going into this, but we don't know the risks. We haven't actually compared a psychedelic retreat like, you know, like going down to, you know, Blue Morpho or one of these, you know, the Temple of the Way of Light or one of these places, you know, and doing your ayahuasca ceremonies. We don't know if that is safer than super intense meditation retreats or not. We can't tell you, you know, so I don't know. But I can tell you that these things are debated and we need good science. So again, if you're a philanthropist or a researcher or someone who wants to be a subject in one of these studies, please give me a call. Because actually, my primary obsession during my day is actually like trying to organize the teams across the globe that are going to be needed to sort out these questions, which we're guessing about, but we don't know yet. Like, and we need to know, because the meditation is scaling just like the psychedelic renaissance. And as this stuff enters the clinical mainstream, most clinicians are not prepared to help people with their profound peak experiences, or they're suddenly thinking they're Jesus for 3 days or whatever. As a friend of mine, you know, who, you know, did some psychedelics, and some people who have done meditation have come to these things where they're like, you know, 3 days of not sleeping and thinking they're like the God King or God Queen of the universe or whatever, and going to bring awakening and the mushroom culture or the whatever, the light from the aliens or whatever it is to everybody in humanity. And they're suddenly like super creative and like on this profound, what looks like a manic episode, but may just be kind of a spiritual high, right? And yeah. And sorting that out from classic bipolar and mental illness, assuming those things are even hard categories, you know, that's another thing we need to do, which is a whole nother part of this where we don't need the predisposing factors. Is this stuff safe for people who have been diagnosed as having schizophrenia or have had psychotic episodes or have bipolar disorder? There are endless debates. If you look at like the Icarus Project, which has sort of shifted its focus recently to social justice, but back when it was more like sort of like mental healthy kind of stuff, like, you know, trying to figure out who should do these things and who shouldn't. What are reasonable exclusion criteria? Are the Grofs right that some people with schizophrenia or who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia may be able to be healed in some way by some of these powerful experiences rather than that being an exclusionary condition? Again, I can't tell you because we don't know. People are just guessing and basing it on a few case studies. Right. Yeah. So I can tell you what the debates are. Unfortunately, I can tell you also that the state of the art is that we don't have great answers. And people who say they know for certain, I'm sorry, I know for certain you don't. right? That's the one thing I'm quite sure.
One thing we're certain about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that I can tell you.
Oh, great. Well, it's a good starting spot. And do you have, it's a slight side tangent, but I'm realizing you might have a perspective on this that'll be valuable, which is, I've often wondered, the terminology that is used in the shamanic circles that I've encountered doesn't actually point in this direction. And I always wondered, to what extent was it imposed by Westerners who have taken Buddhism, whatever, from the East and then gone to South America and then been involved in, you know, shamanic traditions down there. And then finding when I was down there that, you know, it wasn't necessarily focused on the kind of peace and love that I might associate from Eastern traditions. It was kind of quite competitive and witch doctors and,
almost
battling each other out. It's like, oh, I wonder if our sense of ayahuasca moving people in the direction of maybe a Christian notion of enlightenment or a Buddhist notion is really quite different. So you said you'd studied a lot of these maps and cross-culturally.
I've done ayahuasca and I know a lot of people who've done a lot of ayahuasca. I know people who've been on these retreats. That's my close friend circle and like the world I swirl in. It's super, the competition, the weird, you know, anytime you find these shamanic traditions, there's always sorcerers and witches and stuff who are battling it out with each other. It's just par for the course, for better or for worse. But you find people battling it out in the meditation world as well, just the sort of polite version. Sure. Our tradition's better. That teacher's crap. We're doing the right thing. We're the best. They're the worst. You know, and even like the Tibetan black hats, like where they hurl demons at other rival sects and execute each other and battling for hundreds of years, like the monasteries actively assassinated each other and had wars with each other. And right. So like it ends up getting, you know, sorry kids, like the Buddhists who think they're all civilized. Right. Or, you know, you have the monk in Burma who was blessing the troops to go out and do terrible things to the Rohingya and stuff. Right. I mean, like, you know, like none of these traditions are perfectly clean. Right. They've all got, as soon as you get into magic, there's all, every single Western order has noticed this. Every shamanic order has, you know, noticed this. There's the psychopaths, the dominant stuff, the protection and curses and magical battles and turf wars and territory and domination, one-upsmanship, right? Anybody who's ever been in like a Golden Dawnian or OTO order or any of, like, that's just par for the course in the world of magic. Like nobody seems to be exempt from this anywhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. Is it true that the shamanic traditions were almost exclusively, as far as we can tell, concerned with magic and the shamanic aspect of development, which can be very profound, very healing, very magical? Like that's sort of its own whole category. And I don't think that what that has to do with awakening is, like, I think of it as like its own universe or axis of development, right? Of how far you wanted to go into realms and beings and plant spirits and messages and prediction and prognostication and, like, you know, why is somebody sick and, you know, what's the explanation and why, how are we going to heal them and all of that kind of stuff. Like, that's its own axis. That's, you know, shamanism and animism and all of that. And what has that had to do with awakening? Well, almost none of those traditions talk about awakening in the formal sense of like the way, you know, Vedanta does or, you know, the Buddhist traditions do, or even the Christian traditions, which I agree, right? So when you talk about, like, you know, divine marriage and stuff like this, it's very, very rare to see anything like that mentioned in any of the shamanic literature, although you do see a little bit of it and you get some hints of it, but it's a small part of what goes on there, right? Most of it is specifics, psychology or entities or messages or not sort of universal consciousness stuff. Although you do see some of that. I mean, like, I remember being out on the Navajo reservation out in Chinle when I did a month out there working in the ER. And I got to talk to some people. I was also very interested in meditation then as well. And I got to talk to some people about some of the old Native American shaman or whatever, you know, there were, whatever they would call themselves, because shaman really is a word that comes out of, you know, the steppes of Russia or whatever, you know. So we've got to be careful with cultural intermingling in some of these terms and concepts, right? I'm aware of those debates and discussions for anybody who's, you know, apologies for me using these terms in a way that seems unsophisticated. I'm doing it as a sort of a pop shorthand rather than some, like, from an unsophisticated understanding of the fact that these traditions really are all very different in some ways. Yeah. But so, you know, talking about the Native American healers and, like, some of them, you got the sense they did have some very profound appreciation of Great Spirit or, you know, like the sense of God or presence or something that was there. And you see some shamans who do eventually end up with some of that, like, but it's definitely not the emphasis of most of these traditions in their native form. And we're definitely retrofitting a sort of an enlightenment era idealism onto what they were and are. And we do that with Buddhism as well, because a lot of it's highly animist and magical and very weird from a rationalistic Enlightenment point of view.
No. That was great. It was right what I was looking for. And then just to circle back on what you were saying before, you gave us a sense of a scope of the debate and the questions that we don't really have any answers to and no one is certain, but it's clearly something you've thought about a lot. And so I'd still, if you're willing, be interested in your intuition or what you suspect might be found once we've done enough of the research and the science. I guess potentially one way of, and it sounds like you give a lot of people advice, but and you care for all of them, but if a close friend or a brother or a family member came to you with these questions, like, well, should I, I've done some psychedelics, I've had these amazing experiences, I'd like to get more insight into them, or I'm thinking of taking psychedelics, would your advice be like, I suspect you should pull off from that and do more meditation, or I think you should just dive in, or...
Well, it depends on what they want. So, So I it would be super hard for me. Okay, so there's the first question of legality. Some important legal disclaimer. Psychedelics may be illegal and or highly illegal in your country, and you should not break the law. Yes. Okay, that said, if you can go to a country or some place or some situation where psychedelics are legal, so then, speaking purely outside of the questions of legality, you just have to do your research and then see what you like. I would read Arrowhead a lot. I would read a lot of reports because you'll see the good, the bad, the strange. I would learn what these molecules are, how they work, how they compare to other molecules, what kind of experiences people report on them, right? You need to know what you're getting yourself into. Like, would I necessarily tell anybody, you definitely should do Toad or you definitely should do Ibogaine? No, like, I would never say anything like that because I don't know that that's true. Right? I don't know. But like, can consenting adults hopefully attempt to make reasonable choices given enough reasonable information? Yeah, but what we don't have is enough reasonable information. I can't tell you what are the risks you're going to break your brain and 3 years later be calling me up on the phone going like, I did ayahuasca in the jungle and I'm now fucked and I've been fucked ever since. Right. Which I get these calls on occasion. And I certainly can't tell you, are you going to like take Toad and go, oh, my golly, like I'm forever changed. And that was the most profound experience of my lifetime's 1,000 or whatever they say, you know. So like I can't tell you that's going to happen to you because I know people that didn't happen to. Right. So like, I don't know. And so the problem is at this point, we're kind of stumbling around in a darkness that is not totally dark, but it's pretty foggy. And I would say do a lot of research, see what you gravitate towards, talk with a bunch of friends, know what your options are, and research alternatives. So like, what is the world of deep meditation like? Because that's kind of the debate that I end up getting involved in a lot, right? There are other debates. But it's like, should I go do a one-month retreat in Burma at some monastery, or should I go study with Pa Auk and learn to get really good at concentration doing kasina stuff, or should I go do a bunch of fire kasina, which is what people talk to me a lot about, particularly if they like impressive visuals and entities and kaleidoscopic, you know, stuff that, you know, fire casino can get people into that sometimes in a few days.
And just not familiar, can you just say what that is?
So firekasina.org, firekasina.org is where you can go and learn all about the stuff. And you can hear a bunch of people who are sometimes serious tripsters and psychonauts also who appreciate the pedestrian path as well. And they'll talk to you, particularly the recent, the most recent Bryn Garth 2, I think, is where we have some people who are kind of talking about that in that discussion, which is kind of fun. Basically, you look at a light source, depending on the light source, might be just a few seconds if it's a brighter one, or a minute or two if it's a candle flame, which I recommend because it's probably less eye damaging. And then you close your eyes and you follow the colors, like on the back of your eyelids or whatever you see, and then you open your eyes and you do it again. And you do it again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And you do that long enough, and all of a sudden you can get into some wildly psychedelic territory, right? It's just a question of how long, right? Mm-hmm. So for some people might start seeing interesting stuff in some short period of time. For a lot of people, it's going to be somewhere around 50, 70, 100 hours over a week or so, right? So it takes kind of high dose. But then you can get into territory that can be like, you know, I had this thing where all of a sudden for like 10 minutes, I was totally gone from my body in this vast space of these hyper sparkly, hyper geometrically arranged diamonds who would be like super like frozen crystal brightness brilliance in this massive screen display and then rearranged into some different pattern of letters or numbers or just abstract symbols and then freeze and then like all of a sudden boom and like crystal fractal sparkly. God, it was like, you know, like full on DMT kind of stuff. And for 10 minutes, I couldn't have told you where my body was. I couldn't have even found it or known how to get out of this experience, right? Total, complete immersion breakthrough, you know, and that was day 9 of a fire casino retreat for me. You know, it just happened. Mm-hmm. Can I tell you that's going to happen for you? No. Do I know that kind of stuff happens? Yeah, because I've been there and I've traveled to other realms that were as real as this and had massive displays of hypersymmetrical, you know, ultra electric, you know, crystalline patterns of organic, you know, stuff that seemed to be like something related to the Indra's net of the god mind of the universe from the whatever, I don't know, like, but that, you know, it's full on, you know, psychedelic territory, right? Mm-hmm. I just got there totally sober. It just took a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So you can go to Fire Casino. And then this is usually the question I'm getting because these are the things I'm known for, right? So this is the kind mm-hmm. of, you know, or should I be doing advanced tantric visualization practices, which they would be the first to tell you are not necessarily safe. And for the same reasons, none of this stuff is safe, right? You mm-hmm. can get into some super weird experiences. And then the other question is, do you want to live in a magical universe, right? A lot of people think they do until they actually get into a magical universe and they're having to deal with entities and energies mm-hmm. and intuitions and strange vibes they're getting from things and weird messages and creepy synchronicities that seem to have all this import and they're getting into numbers and they're talking to Pleiadians and God knows what. Like, was that the universe they wanted to be a part of? I don't know. Like, but not everybody, a lot of people think it is until they get there and they're like, okay, yeah, maybe not so much. Like it's a funny thing. Right, exactly. Like, I just wanted to like go into a movie and then have the movie end and like be back, right? But yeah. Like that's not what a lot of people
Avengers.
Yes, whatever, like, you know, and like some people, they never thought that was the world they wanted to live in, and they get there and like, oh my god, like I was a scientific materialist for how long? What a friggin' idiot I was, right? Like this is unbelievably better. And so you don't know and I don't know, so I can't tell you ahead of time how this is going to go. I can't predict the future. I can't tell you how well you're going to relate to psychedelic or magical experiences unless you've had some experience with them. And even then, you still don't know what you're going to get, right? Because anybody who's done psychedelics will tell you there may just be one trip that all of a sudden you've been doing this a long time and okay, suddenly, whoa, like that was full on, whoa, okay, I wasn't really ready for that. And the same thing can happen in meditation retreats, right? Mm. And so I can't tell you, I don't know. Like what I can tell you is what things tend to be like. Right? Fire Casino is slower, but can be super profound, but also the come down is slower, right? If you build this stuff into who you are over like 100 hours, your come down might take days or weeks, right? Whereas a lot of people are going into psychedelics because they're quick, right? I remember whatever was like, salvia is going to be like the working man's drug on their lunch break or something. I don't know if you've done salvia, like it's got nothing, like anyway, but like, no, it didn't end up becoming that because it's not addictive, right? Most people are not going to want to do salvia every lunch break and get high or something and then come back down, right? It's just not how people do this most of the time. Some people, but most people, no. And in the same kind of way, like, yeah, I don't know how you're going to react to this stuff. And I don't know what you're going to get. But I can tell you some things are more likely to be certain ways than others. And we can explore what the various chemicals are, the toolboxes are, the techniques. Maybe holotropic breathing, like the Grofs, right? When the psychedelics started getting shut down, the Grofs ended up finding that holotropic breathing could get people into a lot of these similar states. And maybe in a more integrative, whole healing kind of way. Because I've done psychedelics for myself. And I've compared it to the states I get into from deep meditation. I can tell you, while the psychedelic stuff could be super profound, the stuff that I got it to in a much more organic, built-up way over, you know, 100 or 150 hours in meditation has always been cleaner. Like, it's always been cleaner and more navigable and felt more natural and integrated. Like, it didn't have some of that, like, buzzy, psychedelic-y, harsh something that some of these things have had, right? Like, and so, but that said, it took me a long time to get there, and it's more hit or miss. So, like, I'm not... If anybody thinks I'm advocating for one of these over the other, I am truly not. I'm just trying to give an honest, sort of scattergun read. Do your research, talk to your friends, figure out what the alternatives are. Know there's a lot of possibilities. Definitely get set and setting right. Anybody who doesn't understand that, you need to understand that. Because the mind state you go into this, the music you're listening to, the people you're around... Make sure that is really conducive to a journey. And if you're going to go into deep meditation, you want people who know how to handle the weird as well. Right. So we always, and weirdly enough, I actually consider handling psychedelics experience as well, and having experiences with psychedelics is one of the things I look for if I'm like going to do a deep meditation retreat with people. Right. Because then I know if they get into weird, they hopefully can handle it. And if they say, yeah, I can handle trips, and I've also been a trip sitter for other people, that's a real resume builder for me in terms of like, do you want to do like a 3 or 3 week or 1 month fire casino retreat? Because we're going there. But the problem is it might not end in 3 or 6 hours. Right.
So
or 12
like
hours or whatever. Right. So like, you know, like, because then you get a sense, is this for you? You know, whereas people who haven't done those, I'm kind of more nervous going in because they may not have ever had to try to figure out how to handle themselves in the face of the crazy. You know what I mean? And so like, and they may not have those pathways well-worn in terms of like knowing how to navigate and be a decent person in the face of really challenging, powerful experiences. And also to recognize those and be sensitive to them and others, which is an important skill set if you're going to be doing the deep end of meditation practice as well as psychedelics.
This is all brilliant. And for someone who, it's all very spectacular as well, and I'm aware some people listening might just have the kind of very human and modest ambition of reducing their suffering or wanting to be free of suffering, which, you know, a lot of people get into this kind of thing for. And does it seem to you kind of like the hero's journey or whichever metaphor you want, that it's going to go through these crazy scenarios and experiences, or it's just that you don't know and it might therefore be warned, but it's not like a guarantee.
If you're really looking for the end of suffering, like the super deep end, like the deep, because that for me is the deep end of awakening. If you really want that, that's a whole long conversation we need to have. But do I know anybody who's gotten to the really deep end of the profound transformations? I think of like high end, you know, paths, you know, from an awakening point of view, or the really deep transformations of consciousness. I don't know anybody who's gone through it, who hasn't gone through a hero's journey like thing. That doesn't mean it can't happen. I've heard of people it happened to. I don't know any of them. Does that mean you need necessarily psychedelics or intense retreats? No. I know some people who have done this stuff in daily life and not had as super crazy experiences, but they're very rare. The vast majority of us, if you're going to go into the very deep end of what the spiritual life can produce, or it's going to involve some kind of going there. That doesn't mean it's required, because again, I know some exceptions. They're unusual. Now, that said, this stuff is accessible if you haven't had super profound experiences. A lot of people, it's not as hard to get into as most people think, though, as I was just talking about actually in the last person I was talking to, which curiously enough was a high-end neuroscience researcher who's helping with some of the meditation data. Like, we don't know why some people are weirdly insight resistant, where they take a psychedelic and they just kind of see some colors and then they come down, but it's not a mystical experience for them. It doesn't, or whatever you want to call it, it's not a, it doesn't change them. They were just like, oh, that was kind of interesting. And then they go about their day. And other people are like, how is that possible? How could you have seen those realms and not have had it change you? And again, it sort of breaks into these two categories of people, where other people who have gone on months of meditation retreats and they just sort of thought about their issues and they maybe learned to deal with them a little better, but they never got into what I think of as the wild deep end of serious perceptual change, structural change, you know, the wild end of any of that. And are their experiences valid and important for them? Yeah. But is it the deep end of like eliminating suffering? Well, no. But that said, you know, if you just want to calm down, well, maybe like a daily calming meditation practice is a good thing for you, or mindful movement, or Tai Chi actually could be really good. I mean, there's all kinds of cool tech these days, right? I mean, that we live in the great spiritual melting pot. So I could, having talked to thousands of people about their interesting things they combined, I can tell you things that I think are likely to produce certain effects that you may be interested in. And when people say they just want the end of suffering, well, what does that actually mean to them? Some people, it's like to not be re-triggered all the time by their trauma, and how to handle trauma is a whole nother huge topic that I would like need to explore with them, like, and what they've tried and what works for them and what flavors and stuff. Or like, you know, what's their, I don't know. Usually it's like an hour and a half or 2.5 hour conversation with a specific person to try to figure out what, you know, and a lot of question asking. Like, and so there's no easy, quick fix or answer to that question. But but I know that the question is complicated, right? Unfortunately, I don't have good, quick, oh, if everybody just did this, then they'd do this.
Yeah, of course.
I can't say anything like that. It's not so straightforward. I used to think it was. The longer I do this, the more I realize the degree to which I don't think it is. Are there some kind of universals that sort of persist over time? And yeah, okay, we can talk about those, or, you know. But in general, this is complicated. Right. Yeah. And but are there techniques that reproducibly lead to certain effects or make them much more likely, that also have relatively predictable side effect profiles as well? Well, yeah, but that's also true of the psychedelics. You know, like people can say, well, mushrooms are different from mescaline, are different from acid, are different from ketamine, are different from whatever. Like, that doesn't mean it's going to do a specific thing for you when you take it. I can't tell you what your trip's going to be like.
Yeah. Last couple of questions, if that's okay. Yeah, you mentioned there's several other people who are engaged in these debates and giving a lot of thought and their own self-experimentation. Are there any voices that you'd recommend people listening to who are in the public sphere, who are engaged in this, who have interesting things to say?
I think Michael Taft does some really interesting work. So you could check out his Deconstructing Yourself podcast. Mm-hmm. I think that Vince Horn, a year or two ago, I can't remember, maybe a few years ago, he had a little psychedelic series through Buddhist Geeks, had some really interesting conversations, I think, and his wife, Emily Horn, may have been involved in some of those. It's been a while since I listened to them. She's got a cool voice in this as well. If you haven't listened, if you're kind of a newbie to this world, if you haven't listened to Terrence McKenna, you probably should. If you haven't read, you know, Doors of Perception, or if you haven't read How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, or listened to it as an audiobook, you should. These are important aspects and sides of the debate that I think are very interesting. Some of Gordon White's work is interesting on this. He doesn't really talk about the awakening aspect, but he does some interesting stuff. You can look up Rune Soup. It's a podcast. There's lots of others. I mean, this is a pretty interesting space. Some caution, a little bit of, what's the guy's name? Guna? Help me out here. Do you know who I'm talking about? The guy who did like... what's his name? God, my brain is glitchy as heck with names. Maybe Joel, Joe, something. But he did a 5-MeO every day for 30 days.
Oh, okay.
And came to the conclusion, he was like, you know, the most enlightened person ever by a factor of like 50 or something. But then it was mostly memories and not deeply transformative inborn like baseline experience changes. So I would be, he's sort of a cautionary tale. Oh, definitely check out the Qualia Computing Kids. They do some fascinating blogs and work on this stuff. And read like the Manual of Psychedelic Support is very interesting. So you can download that or check out the Zendo Project stuff if you're thinking about doing this. Definitely do your research on Arrowhead. Just read a lot of trip reports, good and bad, and get a sense of the range if you're thinking of doing any of this stuff. There's a lot of honesty there. You'll find some weird stuff too and some propaganda and whatever, you know. But like, get a sense of the range of what's possible. So you're going in as eyes open as you can. Mm-hmm. Right. And just think about your life circumstances. Are you in a place where you suddenly want your life potentially sputtering off in some wild, different journey? You know, do you have kids? Do you have aging parents you're taking care of? What are your social responsibilities? You know, how does your partner feel about this? How does your family feel about this? I don't mean to, like, you know, everybody should have individual freedom, but we are in a social collective. You know, we're in a web of interactions and dependencies and stuff. And just think about where you are and like, do you want to be crashing into weird spiritual territory? And is that something you can risk right now? Mm-hmm. Just responsible spirituality, and keep around you people who, you know, have a long history of not being exploitive, right? So check out like some of the work being done to try to keep spiritual teachers from taking advantage paradigmatically or financially or sexually with the people who are getting their minds very, very opened by these things and then getting very psychedelically or psychologically vulnerable. That happens in the world of meditation as well, right? So, you know, we all have heard the yoga stories and the gurus and stuff. It's just par for the course, unfortunately. But you want to surround yourself with people who are very much not that, and not everybody initially looks like they're not like that. So just keep your wits about you and don't be an idiot about this stuff, right? Because people get hurt and it gives everybody a bad name. And then if you end up in a position where you have some power in a community, really just don't abuse that stuff, you know? Like, the temptation is understandable, like, you know, alpha male dominance or female dominance or whatever. I understand why people do this. That's no justification for it. Go into this with a really strong moral foundation and try to do this stuff responsibly. You know, I'm not trying to be shut down or say don't party or whatever. I get it. Right. I totally understand. But you also hopefully get where I'm coming from, that we need to have some ethics about this, and we need to try to reduce the harm that can come from this. So those would be other messages I would want to put out there. Sorry if I sound old school or fuddy duddy or like, oh, dad, you know, but like, there's reasons for that. I've seen a lot of fucked up stuff come from both deep meditation practice and spiritual pursuits. and psychedelic stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure we've all...
And the yoga world, for that matter.
Of course,
yeah. You know.
I'm sure we've all met casualties of those environments. And,
yep.
And yeah, we all want things to move more in that direction. For a while, it seemed like there was barely a week that went by without finding out about another guru who was being accused of this or investigated for that. And you mentioned a couple of times, you know, hoping for funding and looking for funding. What could we hope to discover, or what would be the ideal thing that we'd discover with the right amount of funding and the right scientific research projects getting underway, and what timeline? And sorry if that's far too broad a question, but
we should get a sense of like
where we hope to arrive to in an ideal situation.
Yeah, so I'm helping to organize a grand project that is just one of many similar projects in the space. We're not the be-all and end-all, and we hope to work with all the other people who are in this space and coordinate and collaborate. Very open science, open research. But it's the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium. And the EPRC is all about... So what I think needs to be done is first the phenomenology. We need to really categorize the stuff the way the naturalists did, right? So just like they went into the jungle and looked around at all the bugs or whatever, and hopefully not put them on pins, but instead go, ooh, that's cool, that's cool. We just need to know what we're dealing with. And there hasn't been a grand compendium of all the experiences that people can have out of this stuff, both in terms of what they have as an experience, but also the sequences in which they unfold. Do they mean this? If you have this one, do you then later get this? Like, what are their predictive, you know, first you figure out what they are, then you see them developmentally, like, oh, this is just the larval form of this butterfly or whatever. You know, in order to do the same thing for spirituality, we need to first know what there's a larva and a butterfly, and then we need to watch them unfold and say, oh, the larva goes into cocoon or the caterpillar, and then it emerges as a butterfly, right? So that would be cool to know. We also notice, oh, by the way, there's this parasitic wasp that jumps on this thing and then injects it with larvae and does this horrible stuff to it and whatever, and that's part of its life cycle. So we need to know what's out there and how it interacts and how it goes down in sequence and what all the variants are. So that's the first thing we need to know. And that work has never really been done in the degree that I, as an obsessive phenomenologist, think it needs to be done. So once we got that, then there's the diagnosis project. We need to figure out, like, how do these kind of fall into clinical diagnostic baskets? And I don't mean to, like, clinical gives people a bad rap because the clinical world has been, like, very anti-religion and anti-spirituality, anti this stuff, like, shut down about... you know, drugs or whatever, pathologizing all this stuff. The DSM has got problems. You know, ICD doesn't have spiritual awakening as a diagnosis, but they sure have problems with related to bipolar and stuff, some of which may have been some spiritual process or whatever that got mislabeled, right? So, but there is a way, I actually believe, because I went into medicine, like most of my colleagues, to help people and not suck when it comes to this stuff, right? We went in to know things rather than be ignorant and actually harmful, which is unfortunately what most of the current medical climate is with regard to spiritual experiences. I don't mean to needlessly disparage my colleagues, but the spiritual world never met them halfway to help them learn this stuff, and they never met us halfway. I don't know which us I am. I'm kind of both, actually, because I'm board-certified ER doctor for 12 years and all that stuff, right? So I've worked in both ends of it. But I still in some way think of myself as more on the spiritual side, even though that was my job for a long time and my training, right? And we never met the clinical world halfway either. And so they need to get together and figure out where is the overlap? Where's the good? Where's the bad? Where's the healing potential, which we know is real? Like those of you who've done this for long enough, we know there are healing stories and healing journey that can happen. And also the damage and the downsides that can result, which we also know are there. And to be able to bring both into the clinical world in a balanced, reasonable way, rather than all the stuff just doesn't exist or pure scientific material, or you're all just crazy, like, or all of this is just going to heal everybody and everybody should be doing this. All of those, I think, are just nuts. Like, just no. Like, sorry, that's just demonstrably not true. But there's a middle ground where we know the good, the bad, the weird, and the possibilities, and we can have a conversation with a patient or a practitioner. This is what your experience is. And then, you know, and then this is the sort of categories we can think of it as that hopefully have some correlation with neural structures and correlation with biochemistry and serotonin and dopamine and, you know, the default mode network and the prefrontal cortex, whatever, and, you know, amygdala and stuff, and go, okay, so hopefully have some categories that are not only diagnostically and clinically meaningful in terms of they predict something and allow you to do something and take advantage of opportunities for healing and growth and also mitigate the dark stuff that's happening. But then we need to fold that into what we call the management project. So the management project is once you know that these things are real and you know these things are happening, if someone presents to you wanting to do something or with a set of symptoms that they want to either do more, get more of, or have less of, or change or modify in some way, right? Both good, you know, so you're embracing the full range of what's possible, then you know how to do that. So you actually have studies where we followed people, and all the traditions have all these ideas. Oh, this is the thing that will mitigate the dark night and get you to awakening the fastest, or this is the thing that will get you the deepest psychological healing the fastest, or this is the thing that will make you a full Buddha in this lifetime, or whatever it is. Like, you know, we have all these, you know, ideas, or this is the thing that will be, you know, give you the most profound mystical journey and the deepest depths of, you know, archetypal resonance and shadow work or whatever. Well, we don't know that any of that's true, but it's all interesting. And I think we should study it and we should compare these things. A bunch of traditions say they get you to the awakening of fastest. Well, is that true? What even is awakening? What are the range? What are the possibilities? What are the stages? What actually does unfold? Like, from just a real clinic, I think science has something to really lend this conversation, just like kind of mixed martial arts lend to the conversation of the violent arts, hopefully the peaceful arts. We can add something, you know, of an external perspective that really says, okay, yeah, you're all the best and whatever, but let's actually follow you longitudinally and see who actually does become more kind and wise and integrated and helpful, or more deep and profound and healing, or more magical, or more, you know, less suffering and more wisdom, or whatever it is, you know, like that people are looking for, because people are looking for a lot of different stuff. And so we need the management project, which is like how you handle these things and take advantage of the opportunities and mitigate the downsides. But we also need, like, then the practice project for the people who want to just cultivate the deep end, who didn't end up in this stuff through some process they weren't expecting to find themselves in with it, that sort of might have been sort of pathological to them. How do you wake up or become kind or loving, you know, as fast as you can with as few resources, hopefully, as you can? It sounds like spiritual materialism, but in honest, you know, people have kids and jobs and lives and stuff. We don't have endless resources and time to dedicate to this stuff. Maybe there are techniques that are actually faster and better and will allow you to do, heal from your trauma the fastest, or going, you know, go into this, you know, with the least risk, or go into this with the maximum adventure, because you have different types. Or people are like, oh, I don't want to avoid, you know, go into the dark night. People are like, bring it on, man. I want the full experience, yeah, whatever. Like, right, the roller coaster. Some people are into that. And being respectful of these different aesthetics and endpoints and going, okay, how do we help people with what their goals are and meet them where they are and not clinically pathologize people and also be paid for this stuff? So you, and then do the neuroscience and the biochemistry to figure out how do pharmaceuticals interact with this. We don't know how all the pharmaceuticals, not only the illegal ones and the illicit ones, right, the healing plant medicines or whatever, but also things like how do the antidepressants, the SSRIs, the antipsychotics, the mood altering drugs, the lithium, how do they modulate or mitigate these journeys, right? Do they mess them up? Do they help people be more stable during them? Do they, some people think these people stop, it'll stop the process and they'll be forever in this sort of like in-between adolescent state where their growth journey was never really allowed to unfold because we medicated them. And other people are like, no, I would have friggin' killed myself if they haven't given me minus psychotics. Like, that helped me, right? And we haven't sorted that out. And so to actually do the pharmaceutical trials, right, to get the indications and say, no, this really actually does do this and it works by this pathway and we know this because in this experience they have this type of dopamine thing or this serotonin receptor is doing this or whatever, or this biochemical pathway, right? And I think that science will actually have a lot to lend to enhance that. But unfortunately, just clinical trials are billions of dollars, right? Just to bring a single new drug to market is $2.6 billion on average through the FDA in the U.S. and I don't know about the rest of the world, probably a lot. Right. And so, like, this stuff is expensive. Right. So to do long term, if you're going to do a few hundred person trials of like deep spiritual practices and actually have enough people to have scientific, meaningfully outcomes over years on a bunch of different axes, that's millions of dollars. Right. So, you know, and this will take decades, you know, 10, 20 years for a pretty good start for a lot of this stuff, I think is what it'll take. And, you know, my initial thing is say, hey, you got $50 million, I could spend it right now. And if you got a few hundred million, that would be even better. Not that I can't do things with someone if, you know, a donor wanted to give, say, hey, I got $20,000. What could you do with it? I could do something with it right now that would be meaningful and help the project move forward. Yeah. But realistically, big clinical trials that establish whole new fields of science and whole new biochemical pathways and clinical indications and medication interactions and how the psychedelics interact with different spiritual practices, and which, you know, that's decades, right? And that's teams across the world. That's a lot of research universities I'm helping to organize right now. I've got maybe 30, researchers at some really cool institutions who are interested in doing this work. We'll probably need a few hundred, right? Just like, you know, people doing cardiology research or people doing cancer research. This is that. So you need to think on that scale, because this is the brain, and the brain is super complicated. But millions and millions of people are now meditating. Millions of people are taking psychedelics, right? The stuff is scaling, and clinical medicine and the world of, you know, psychotherapy and, you know, psychiatry is mostly very far behind. Certainly the mainstream, the transpersonal people have been doing this for a while. But I've been reviewing a lot of the transpersonal literature, and it kind of sucks. I don't mean to, like, it's important that it's there, but it looks really primitive to me, right? Yeah. It doesn't look like what we need. And it's because it was highly underfunded and fringe and on the edge and like, okay, but it's a start, right? It's an interesting beginning to a discussion, but that's all it is, right? Yeah. We need vastly better than that. And that's going to take a lot of money. So again, if you happen to be a philanthropist who has deep pockets, who's got a tolerance for projects who take decades, but you think could really, you know, change humanity, come talk to me. And I, again, I'm asking for no money for myself. I'm asking just money for my research colleagues who are in academic positions and in institutions. We would be giving the institutions directly, the organization I'm starting, the EPRC, actually who doesn't want to hold any money. We just want you to give directly to the people who will do the science, that will answer the questions, that will hopefully figure all this stuff out. And then there are actually like even military applications, you know, concerns, national security concerns. I could get into all that. Like, it gets, you know, concerns for astronauts. What do you do if they have spiritual experiences in a deep space mission journey? Already 4 astronauts have crossed what I would call the arising and passing away, or what people would call mystical peak experiences while they were up. Luckily, nothing bad has happened yet, but it's just a matter of time before some multi-billion dollar project gets screwed up by some, you know, astronaut that now thinks they're the cosmic Jesus or whatever, who's going to bring, you know, the divine message to Mars or something. You know, that's going to happen. It's just a question of time, you know. So, because being in space is very contemplative, right? It's like there you are, like,
and the rising and passing state. This is the stage you consider the point of no return for most people.
Yeah, it's a point of no return. You can't go back, right? So I don't know what it does to the brain. We need to find that out. But you're different after that. There's no change. You know, you're in the journey now, and you're gonna cycle. Have a nice day. Sorry. Like, that just seems to be physiological. I don't know anybody who's crossed it who didn't end up, now they're on the path somehow.
Daniel, this has been amazing. And if part of your goal is to dislodge any certainty, I tend not to be a very certain person in general, but I had small little remnants of certainty or suspicion, and you certainly dislodged those. It really brought to light how little we know, at the same time as how much we actually know of how much information is out there and how much experimentation is going on. So I'm sure anyone listening as well will have a similar sense of how vast and deep and interesting this discussion is, and how much more of it there is yet to come. So much gratitude.
Any other questions or anything? Is that it?
I think it's going to take me a little time to digest and integrate a lot of what you've said. But if you're open for it, I'd certainly love to have a part two at some stage.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
When I've got a little bit more of a refined. Yeah. But it's, you know, I thought, perhaps arrogantly, I thought I knew a thing or two about this field, but it's been like, I've certainly learned a lot, and you've opened up a lot of doors, or at least pointed in the direction of those doors.
Delightful. Well, hopefully everybody will do this in a way that is as responsible as can be with regard to any of these topics, any practices where you're doing deep spiritual stuff. Just realize that was Trump's recent thing. It is what it is. This is what it is, and it's complicated.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, good luck.